From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, why the editorial page editor of the New York Times went fly fishing during his midlife crisis. We talk with Howell Raines about his fly fishing memoir and about recent changes in the New York Times editorial policy. Also, we talk with Ralph Wiley about his new collection of essays, What Black People Should Do Now. Wiley writes about race and likes to make his readers angry. And Maureen Corrigan reviews a new book of essays by E.L. Doctorow. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The House continues to wrestle over the North American Free Trade Agreement with Mexico and Canada, but the White House appears to be nearing a narrow victory. Although opponents of the trade pact are out in full force, a number of undecided lawmakers have announced today that they'll back the agreement. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
As the long-awaited vote nears, the White House and NAFTA supporters can't hide their confidence, which appears to be growing by the hour. A number of Republicans who'd indicated they were either undecided or leaning against the agreement surprised opponents by siding instead with the White House. Several Democrats who intend to vote against the agreement have said publicly they believe the president will win this battle. Coming off of the floor this morning, Connecticut Democrat Sam Gaydenson, who does not support NAFTA, waved off a lobbyist wearing a pro-NAFTA button. "You guys have got it," he said. The halls of the Capitol are lined with lobbyists, union members and environmentalists on one side and representatives of large corporations on the other. Although the majority of members are decided, lobbyists on both sides of the issue are present to remind lawmakers of their commitments. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Texas billionaire Ross Perot, one of the most high-profile opponents of NAFTA, acknowledged today that the House appears certain to pass the agreement. Perot told reporters that he's conceded the vote, but in his words, "But then what?" Earlier today, Perot predicted that working-class families would flock to his United We Stand America organization if NAFTA passes. Polls have shown that Perot's opposition to NAFTA has so far failed to expand his base of political support beyond the nearly 20% of votes he won in last year's election. A federal appeals court in Cincinnati is accusing the Justice Department of misconduct in connection with the case of John Demjanjuk. Lorna Jordan of member station WVXU reports.
The Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that the Justice Department's Nazi Hunting Office of Special Investigations did not give Demjanjuk the necessary paperwork which may have proven his claim that he was the victim of mistaken identity. Demjanjuk was stripped of his citizenship, deported to Israel, and tried for being Ivan the Terrible. He was convicted, but last summer the Israeli Supreme Court overturned that decision. Attorneys for the former auto worker are trying to win back his citizenship, and today the appeals court said he will be allowed to remain in the United States while the extradition case is pending. Demjanjuk is now living at his home in suburban Cleveland. For National Public Radio, I'm Lorna Jordan in Cincinnati.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street as investors took profits from shares that ran up in value during yesterday's record high session. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 6 points to close at 3,704.35. Declines led advances by a 4-3 margin. This is NPR. The South African government and leaders of most of the country's major black and white political parties have approved a new constitution that will end white majority rule. The white-dominated parliament is expected to ratify the document next week. The constitution will provide the basis for a multiracial transitional executive council that will rule the country until South Africa's first all-race elections next April. Sicilian mafia godfather Luciano Ligio has been buried without a funeral ceremony in his hometown Corleone. As Francis Kennedy reports, Ligio died from a heart attack in an Italian jail.
Sicilian police ruled that for reasons of public order, Ligio could not receive a funeral in Corleone or Palermo. A handful of family members, plus a crowd of journalists, welcomed the police convoy carrying the body of one of the most ruthless mafia bosses. He was then buried in the family vault. Under Li Jo's leadership, the Corleonesi clan moved from the country to Palermo, from contraband to international drug trafficking, winning the great mafia war of the 1980s. Li Jo's death and the capture earlier this year of his successor marks the end of an era for the Corleonesi clan. And the town of Corleone goes to the polls on Sunday to elect a new council to replace the one dissolved for mafia infiltration. For National Public Radio, I'm Frances Kennedy in Rome.
The nation's Catholic bishops called today for continued U.S. involvement in world trouble spots and for greater involvement by men in the domestic lives of their families. At their annual fall meeting today, the bishops issued a follow-up to their peace pastoral of 1983 and a policy statement on the family. The 1993 peace message called on the United States to resist isolationism, to stop being the world's major weapons dealer, and to maintain the ban on nuclear testing. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Newspaper editorials are unsigned. You may often find yourself wondering who's writing and whose opinion you're reading. Some of that curiosity is about to be satisfied. My guest is the editorial page editor of the New York Times, Howell Raines. He doesn't write all the editorials himself, but he writes many of them. He's been at the job since the beginning of the year. Before that, he was a Washington correspondent and then Washington editor for the Times. When he needs a break from the pressure, he goes fly fishing. In fact, he's written a memoir called Fly Fishing Through the Midlife Crisis. I spoke to Raines in September when the book was published. He first learned to fish in Alabama, where he grew up. What's so special about fly fishing?
I became afflicted or blessed with a passion for fishing at the age of 7. And I've done it all my life. And sometime in my 40s, I began to realize that what the thing I had loved had become a burden. And part of that was that I was using it as a competition. It was an extension of my work. And what Dick Blaylock, the hero of my book, my guru, did was teach me that fly fishing, is not about catching fish. And I learned to enjoy the activity itself, not the body count.
So tell me, now that you have learned the lesson that fly fishing isn't about catching fish, it isn't about being competitive, it's about the process. It's about being alone. It's about being with nature. You're applying these lessons to the New York Times, that it's about the process of getting the news. It's about the process of thinking through your position. It's not about competing with the Washington Post.
That's the most dangerous and threatening segue I've ever heard. one of the great challenges in my life, I suppose, is to transport the spiritual peace I feel on the South Fork of the Snake River in the Swan Valley area of Idaho to 43rd Street, and it ain't easy.
That doesn't strike me as something you'd really want to get rid of, the competitive spirit in the newsroom and at the paper.
Competition is at the heart of journalism as it's practiced in America, and one of the reasons I loved working in Washington was that Washington still has, and New York still has, what is missing from many American cities these days, which is a competitive journalistic environment. And frankly, I love the feeling of every day undertaking an activity where you know you're going to be up against the best in the business. And that's the case in Washington. It's the case in New York. Maybe if I talk about a competition as the curse of fishing, I suppose it's the lifeblood of the business that I'm in now. And I was greatly influenced as a young person growing up in Alabama when Bear Bryant was the football coach at the University of Alabama. And Bear Bryant had a charismatic quality to him that when he walked on the field, you knew that there was going to be a football game held there today, and that win, lose, or draw, it would be played with energy and passion. And I've been lucky in my life to be in a profession where I've always had the feeling that I've worked with people who, when you walked in a newsroom with them, you knew there was going to be journalism committed there today.
Let's talk about a moment when fly fishing and journalism kind of came together, and I'm thinking of the time you went fishing with George Bush.
Yeah.
This is when you were a Washington correspondent for the Times, or Washington editor for the Times. So
what
did you learn about the president by fishing with him that you wouldn't have learned by interviewing him?
Well, one thing I learned is that my friend and colleague Maureen Dowd was right about the manic devotion that he brings to sport. I mean, I'm pretty tough about going fishing, and I've been out on some nasty days, but this was a cold, windy day, and I thought maybe, you know, we'd sit around the White House and have coffee and donuts, but no, there there we are banging down the Potomac with the wind whistling through the trees at 30 miles an hour or so, radically underdressed for the temperature. That was the most disenchanting business. One would think that when the president gets up that there's a cadre of people around with barometric readings and temperature forecasts saying, you know, wear this wool jacket or that cotton shirt. And the poor guy's out there in a light windbreaker, and he said what I thought was very interesting, that here's what our government could bring to bear in terms of advice for what attire to wear. He awakened Mrs. Bush about 4 a.m. and said, should he wear his long underwear today? And she said no and went back to sleep. So the president gets the same level of advice that every fisherman in America gets, I suppose, which is leave me alone, I'm going back to sleep.
So,
but he was quite a genial host, I must say.
You've been very critical of Bush over the years. Did you feel more warmly toward him? Did this fishing episode with him affect the way you covered him afterwards?
No, it didn't. I suppose it deepened the mystery of George Bush for me. I have found him to be an unfailingly polite person who has a real gift for putting people at ease and communicates caring about talking to you in a way that a figure like Reagan did not. Reagan has this great aura of amiability in his public persona, but when you're talking to him, you don't get any real sense of him relating to you as an individual. You do get that with George Bush. That always was puzzling to me because I couldn't see the leakage of the transference of what I regard as his wonderful personal qualities into his politics, which seemed to be very mean-spirited with regard to women, with regard to the homeless, for example. And so I didn't solve that paradox. I simply reported. To get back to your question, no, it didn't affect the way we covered or commented upon Bush.
You took over as editorial page editor of the Times in January of 93. Can you give us a job description?
Yeah, I have a very interesting answer to that question. It came to me several months into it, and my job is I get paid to think about America, and it's quite a wonderful experience, and I feel lucky to have it. I can go on in more detail if you'd like.
Yeah, about a little more nuts and bolts.
Yeah. We have an editorial board of about 15 people, and we meet three times a week to discuss current events. And we have specialists in areas, economics, healthcare, foreign policy. But part of the intellectual challenge is that every member of the board tries to read broadly across the range of public affairs. And in these thrice weekly meetings, we have wide-ranging discussion to try to arrive at what we think ought to be the editorial position of the paper on the whole gamut of public issues. Now, what's interesting about this is that it's very different from the life of a reporter, which was my life for over 20 years, or even the life of an editor in the news section, which was my life for 8 or 9 years, where you have a kind of rifle vision approach. You were typically dealt, you know, one subject or a small number of subjects to deal with that day, and you really zero in on them. An editorialist really has to be looking at the whole horizon, and it's a daunting challenge to try to be as conversant with healthcare as one is with the Middle East or for that matter, the impact of the flood on the Middle American economy at any given time.
What are the political and stylistic changes you wanted to make when you took over the editorial page?
I'm an English major, And at one time, I thought I was going to be an English professor, and I got a master's degree in English. And I was greatly influenced by the philosophy of the Romantic poets. And that philosophy was that good poetry, in their case, is to inform and delight. And I would say good journalism, all good writing, has to fulfill those two functions, and it's not intellectually complete if it doesn't. So my primary ambition was to have editorials that were vehicles of information, but that created, in a literary sense, real delight in the reader, that they were challenging and fun to read. Delight doesn't mean in a hedonistic sense of pleasure, although humor is part of intellectual delight. Now, what is slightly radical about that, I suppose, in editorial terms, is the editorialists of America have traditionally believed in eat-your-peas journalism. We're going to give you some good policy this morning, and you've got to sit down at the table and eat every bite, or you haven't done your duty as a serious citizen. I think, you know, for today's readers, particularly the readers of the New York Times, you're not fulfilling your duty as a journalist unless you give them a good meal of policy, but also do so in a way that is literarily satisfying.
Well, let me read an excerpt of an editorial that I think you wrote.
Uh-oh, you're moving from theory to...
to practice.
Okay.
This was about the earth-shattering, the earth-shaking issue of inviting Fleetwood Mac for the inaugural.
Right.
And the editorial was headlined, "Might as well book Mojo Nixon."
Right.
And you wrote, "What we have here is confirmation of our deepest fears. The hall monitors have taken over, and in this case, been put in charge of music for the senior prom. If the Clintons want geriatric rockers, they should call John Fogerty or Neil Young." Did you have to, like, bring in the rock critics as advisors before
now,
writing this?
You're talking to a man who's been educated by his sons, one of whom is the lead guitarist of a New Orleans funk group called Galactic Prophylactic. So I'm probably the only person on the New York Times of my age who's not in the culture section who can actually quote the works of Mojo Nixon. I actually did know Mojo Nixon, and of course, since Neil Young and John Fogerty are my age, I've been listening to them for 30 years. But I actually knew the references in that work. And one of the things, I did want to have some fun with that editorial, but the reward of that editorial is I got an incredible number of letters from young people who said, "I'm astonished that someone on the New York Times editorial board would know who Mojo Nixon is. I feel better about America." I'm not sure some of the people who wrote defending Fleetwood Mac felt better about America. I was accused. I also took a shot at the Eagles, and that outraged a lot of people. But, you know, I thought that period of 70s rock that spawned the Eagles and Fleetwood Mac was sort of vacuous. You know, they didn't have the rough vitality of 60s rock or even the rudeness of 80s rock. So anyway, that was the source of that editorial. Thank you for quoting it. I was very proud of that editorial.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Howell Raines. He's editorial page editor of the New York Times and author of a new memoir called Fly Fishing Through the Midlife Crisis. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Hal Raines, editorial page editor of the New York Times, is my guest. I want to ask you about the process of deciding what kinds of editorials to write after the Israeli PLO agreement was signed.
Yeah.
The day after the agreement was signed, you had an editorial on the editorial page, basically focusing on the more symbolic, ceremonial aspects of the agreement and being, you know, very kind of positive about that. But then the day after that, the editorial was more about all the hard work that needs to be done and all the possible dangers
right.
that lay along the way. Can you talk with us a little bit about the process of deciding what to focus on and when?
Yeah, I can, and I'll confess to some frustration here. I'll take the first editorial first. I thought this was such a striking event, watching the scene on the White House lawn. I'm not a big one for editorials or any kind of journalism that simply mark a moment, but this moment I thought was so riveting, and particularly I was struck by Rabin's speech. This was a man who was a 26-year-old company commander in the 1948 war, and now through the long arc of this soldier's life, he's striking this historic grasp for peace, that I wanted a piece that I thought really rose to the occasion. And I don't think that the piece that we wound up writing had that grandeur to it. And I take responsibility for that. Several of us struggled with it. And I think we were actually so caught up in the effort that we kind of froze up. But anyway, we tried to mark the grandeur of the moment. And I feel somewhat less frustrated by that because I read a quote from Letty Pogrebin in our paper saying she's a wonderful writer, and she's saying this event sort of reduced her to verbal cliches as she tried to talk about it. So the first editorial was trying to celebrate the moment, and I think it was a worthy moment. I'm not sure we did it full justice. The second editorial, I think what we made the conscious decision to say, okay, after the ceremony, the life that must now be lived in these places is going to be difficult. What are the questions of autonomy, of economics, of daily existence that could drive people apart and make this peace hard to achieve? So that was what we were trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Do you have pretty heated discussions about the Middle East when you have editorial meetings? I think it's one of the areas of the world in which it is most difficult to reach agreement.
Absolutely. It's interesting. These kinds of long-term issues, I think, go through cycles. Actually, since I came to the board in January, we've been at a moment where the peace initiative that was started by the Bush administration has seemed to have a kind of steady momentum. We were earlier in the year editorializing, urging the Clinton administration not to let this slip off the agenda. But in terms of kind of passionate debate, it's interesting, that particular issue, while it lends itself to that, we were in a period where there was kind of a clear diplomatic theme. And I'm thinking, as I'm answering, the place where we've had real passionate debate in this period in terms of people having widely divided opinion has been on Bosnia.
Mm-hmm.
There I found myself, frankly, in disagreement with some of my colleagues who felt very strongly that the United States needed to intervene militarily. And as a member of the Vietnam generation, I felt very strongly that you cannot ask American service people to die in a cause for which there's no political consensus in the country and no political will in the Congress. Well, so we had very heated discussions about Bosnia, for example.
So who decides who wins, so to speak, when the editorial staff is divided?
At the end of the day, under our system of management, the editor decides. And
that's you.
And that is me. There's a wonderful essay about the life of an editorial page editor by Phil Jalen, the retired editor of the Washington Post, who discussed these structures. The Post has basically the same one that we do, and indeed most of the major papers do. The editor has a board. That board is a kind of a collegial intellectual entity, but at the end of the day, the editor gets to decide what the policy is if there's no consensus. And Phil Jalen in his book said, also, in every case, the publisher has the final editing power by removing the editor. So I suppose we all live in that world that's the way American newspapers are structured.
One of the big changes I've noticed on the editorial page is that the Times, which used to, for instance, never use the word gay and rarely write about gay issues, in the past year or so has had a lot of editorials in support of gay rights, a lot of op-ed pieces about gay issues. What's behind that change?
Well, I don't know what's behind the change. I can only speak for myself because I didn't experience it as a change. And I should have said the editorials that I think have had an impact. I have been, as the board has been, very taken with the issue of gays in the military, and I felt Clinton was wrong to cave in by not doing this as an executive order, and I felt we were very critical of the Joint Chiefs of Staff for opposing the president on this. And we have simply, it's an issue that I think has been of importance to society, and we've stuck to it. And in the National Association representing gay and lesbian journalists, which is one of the fastest growing journalistic organizations in the country, now has 850 members, up from only a handful a few years ago, singled out our editorials on gays in the military for an award. And we're very proud of that because I think we really have stuck with that issue. But to me, frankly, coming out of my background generationally and having grown up in the South during the Civil Rights Revolution and having that be the event that has shaped my life more than any other, both in terms of what I believe and the opportunities that were opened by that revolution, not just to black people but to white people from the South, these are the kinds of issues, the abortion, gay rights, that I'm attracted to. I mean, you know, that there's a great line in Tom Wicker's book about the one of the battles in Virginia during the Civil War, and a messenger is looking for Stonewall Jackson, and he asks an old rebel soldier, where's General Jackson? And the soldier replies, just follow the gunfire, there be Stonewall. And I think a journalist, you know, you've got to go to the issues, you've got to go to the gunfire in the metaphorical sense, issues that people care about with passion. And I suppose that's what we've been doing.
One last question: when you're fishing, say, down in Louisiana or something,
yeah,
do you have to get the Times that day? Did you bring the Times with you on the boat?
No. One of the nice things about Leeville, Louisiana, where I fish with my great friend Bobby Bryan, who appears in the book as the master of the redneck way, is no newspapers get to Leeville with any regularity. Sometimes not even the New Orleans paper. So it's a news-free zone down there.
Are you allowed to spend a day without reading the paper?
Yeah. Some days I actually do it at work, which is a dirty little secret. But no days without news of some sort. And, we have a joke on the Times that you can either work for the New York Times or read all of it every day, but you can't, but you can't do both. But I feel guilty if I don't go through the paper every day, but I went into kind of a warp this morning. We had an article about rebuilding a barn in Vermont, and that excited my fantasy of having a cabin of my own in New England, Almorada, Jackson Hole, or any of about seven other places that I'm sure a lot of us could name. But I try to read it all every day.
Hal Raines, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome. I had a good time.
Howell Raines is editorial page editor of the New York Times and author of the memoir Fly Fishing Through the Midlife Crisis. Our interview was recorded in September. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Essayist Ralph Wiley doesn't care who he alienates, whites, blacks, Eurocentrists, Afrocentrists. He says he just wants to get people thinking. Coming up, we'll talk about his new collection of essays, What Black People Should Do Now. And speaking of essayists, Maureen Corrigan reviews E.L. Doctorow's first book of essays, Jack London, Hemingway, and the Constitution. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. As a vote in the House on the North American Free Trade Agreement draws closer, it appears now that supporters of the trade agreement have enough votes for approval. Former presidential candidate Ross Perot, a strong opponent of the measure, has conceded that he believes the House will approve the agreement. Earlier, during debate on NAFTA, some demonstrators tried to disrupt proceedings. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Illinois Republican Henry Hyde had just begun his remarks supporting the free trade agreement when the demonstrators who said they were from the Greenpeace environmental group tossed fake $50 bills onto the House floor.
If cheap labor is the secret and not infrastructure, not marketing a bill...
The disturbance was short as Capitol Hill security officers dragged the demonstrators away. Congressman Hyde responded, saying, "That's the last time I wear that aftershave lotion." I'm Richard Gonzalez at the Capitol.
The Senate has approved a ban on 19 assault weapons as part of its anti-crime package. Senator Joseph Biden, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, says he hopes the House will accept the amendment because public support is growing for restrictions on guns. The bill also approves money to be spent on hiring some 100,000 local police officers and construction of 10 prisons and military-style boot camps for young offenders. Another part of the bill calls for mandatory life sentences for anyone convicted in a federal court of a felony for the third time. Pentagon studies show a decline in the quality of military recruits this year. The 1993 figures indicate the number of high school graduates is down 4%. NPR's Martha Raddatz has that story.
The Pentagon says all four military services met or exceeded recruitment goals, but the figures show that the education level among those who joined is dropping. The Army showed the largest fall, from 100% to 95% high school graduates. The figures are an indicator of the military's ability to attract high-quality recruits during a time of budget cutbacks. Today, Secretary of Defense Les Aspin said the statistics did not worry him. Aspin told reporters the numbers looked a little weak at the midpoint in the year, but that the results for the year looked quite good. The Pentagon also noted that 1992 had been a record year for attracting quality recruits, due to a large degree, it is believed, because of the success of the Persian Gulf War. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 6 points to close at 3,704.35 on volume of more than 317 million shares. This is NPR News. In South Africa, a draft constitution to end white minority rule has been approved. President F.W. de Klerk and African National Congress leader Nelson Mandela were among those signing the interim agreement. Next week, Parliament considers the document that is to take effect after the country's first all-race election, slated for April 27th. In Bosnia, a UN aid worker was shot and wounded on the eve of talks between the various warring factions aimed at getting assurances of safe passage for UN aid convoys. For the first time since peace talks were suspended 2 months ago, Serbian, Croatian, and Muslim leaders will meet in Geneva at the request of the UN High Commissioner on Refugees. Richard Carruthers reports from Zagreb.
The aid worker was wounded in the shoulder when his clearly marked UN car was shot at 25 miles northwest of Sarajevo. A UN spokesman could not say who carried out the attack, but said it took place on territory controlled by the mainly Muslim Bosnian army. The incident underlines the dangers facing aid workers. All convoys into central Bosnia were suspended last month when a Danish driver was killed in an ambush. Around 1.5 million people are now cut off from humanitarian supplies. At the Geneva meeting, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Sadako Ogata, will demand guarantees UN personnel will no longer be targeted before she allows convoys to resume. Whatever the leaders promise, though, they may not be able to control their fighters. For National Public Radio, this is Richard Carruthers in Zagreb.
After the UN Security Council voted to call off a search in Somalia for General Adid, UN officials in that country said this did not mean that their job was over and it was time to pack up and go home. Last night, the UN Security Council voted for a new investigation into attacks on UN peacekeepers in Somalia, even though supporters of Adid have been blamed for many of these attacks. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Ralph Wiley likes to give his books provocative titles. His first collection of essays was called Why Black People Tend to Shout. His new collection is titled What Black People Should Do Now. He tackles subjects like male-female relationships, Afrocentrism, and how the Clarence Thomas hearings divided the African-American community. And he writes about such people as Magic Johnson, Marion Barry, Steven Seagal, and Spike Lee. Wiley co-wrote Lee's book about the making of Malcolm X. Wiley has also worked for the Oakland Tribune and Sports Illustrated. He told me why he gave his new book the title, What Black People Should Do Now.
The title is satirical. I meant to send up people who are offering up pronouncements as to what black people should do now, as if black people were this monolith. I wanted to at first satirize, started off as a satire, and then try to show some of the range of what's going on today. If I were really trying to title the book more precisely or more literally, I would have titled it Semi-Satirical Notes on Popular Contemporary American Culture from a Somewhat Masculine African-American Perspective, and everybody would have dropped dead asleep by the time I'd finished with that title. So this title is intended to, as most of my work is intended to provoke thought. And I think it's the artist's responsibility, because everybody else has got to get a rating or got to get elected or got to get tenure. And there's always these outside influences coloring their perceptions or their responses. And I wanted to give a pure response.
You have a couple of essays that are set in Africa that are about your trips there. Mm-hmm. One of them is called Do All Black People Know Each Other?
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of about the expectations that African Americans have of Africans and Africans of African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
You use two examples of two Africans who you met there who were very different in temperament and very different in the way they related to you. Let me ask you to describe them both.
Well, in the essay, Do All Black People Know Each Other, which, again, it's a satire. It describes a meeting that I had in the Eastern Sahara outside Cairo with a number of African men. It was a group of men. Two of the men were, one was named Mansuru Ofemi Oyeburi. He was a 23-year-old recent graduate of medical school from Nigeria. One of the most handsome men I've ever met in my life. Black as velvet at midnight, bone white teeth, exquisite scarification in the corners of his eyes, eyebrows at a very quizzical up tilt. Beautiful man. And as a matter of fact, I'm pretty much AC myself, Terry, but I looked at this man and said, my goodness, you are a handsome man. And he looked at me and said, I know it. And so it dawned on me, you know, he's handsome, at least in part, because he does not think he's ugly. And he was very quiet. He was listening, and as the rest of us were talking. And one of the most talkative gentlemen was another man named, I won't call his name. He was from Ghana. But he had all these affectations, which really came out of his exposure to the popular, worldwide, really popular culture, popular medium. He was using all these colloquialisms that are part of the dialect of some African-American cities. Yo, what's going on, G? What's up, man? I'll be back here. And it was quite arresting to hear this in the Sahara Desert. I mean, it sort of stunned me. And when I couldn't respond to me, his seeming respect and fascination with me was stripped away, and there was the contempt. There was the contempt that was left.
When you got back, I think it was when you got back to the States,
mm-hmm.
He called you and asked you for like $500 or something to help him with his studies.
Right.
What was your reaction to that, and how did you go about saying no? It's very hard to say no when somebody asks you a favor. Of course, the more money they ask for, the easier it is to say no. But
what was
your attitude about how to handle that and how to interpret the request?
Yes, well, that did happen. And if it had been Mansuru Ofemi Oyeburi who had called me after I got back to the States and asked me for $500, I probably would have sent it to him, you know, because I knew he wouldn't have wanted to ask. But my other friend, he seemed to feel that it was my duty or something, or he wanted to make me feel as though it were my duty. And I'm so accustomed to fighting against manipulation of any sort that it was very easy for me to see it.
When you thought he was playing on your sense of duty to do what? What do you think he was trying to manipulate within you?
The bond or perceived bond that he and I would have as Africans. But you see, that still requires, I mean, that's not enough. You got to have more than that. You got to have more in common than that. You've got to have a better understanding of each other than just that, than just the perceived point of origin. And that's what I mean by the Afrocentrists and the Eurocentrists. They both equal. If they only knew, they could get together on me, and maybe they could come together over me.
Throw your surprise party.
Right, but that's kind of what I'm trying to do. If the artist allows himself or herself to be the lightning rod, you're hoping that people will think through or think beyond their emotional response and might even see what they have in common.
Do you feel that you are often pressured to like choose a side to be in a camp, whether it's like the Afrocentric camp or the more Eurocentric camp, or whether you should be siding with the black man or the black woman? And do you know what I mean? Do you feel that you're trying to kind of steer a course that doesn't deal with sides but just deals with your point of view as you see it?
That's exactly what I'm trying to do, Terry, is to do exactly that and to show and to live out that you should trust no ideology blindly.
No, what are the pressures from
Oh, well, everywhere
camps?
I go, depending on the crowd, you see, depending on their precious little turf that they're trying to defend, it could be because I'm sending up the elite white power structure. I'm sending up the black grassroots leadership. I'm sending up the Afrocentrists. I'm sending up the Eurocentrists. I'm sending up black men. I'm sending up black women. I mean, everybody's turn comes. And when your turn comes, yes, it's gonna sting a little bit.
My guest is Ralph Wiley, author of the new book, What Black People Should Do Now. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Writer Ralph Wiley is my guest. You've written a lot about sports over the years. You were at Sports Illustrated for 9 years.
Right.
Now, your grandfather and your uncle, I believe, were both prize fighters.
Right.
Were they celebrities in their neighborhoods?
Not at all.
Really?
Interesting question, Terry. Not at all. No more so than the mortician, or probably less. In fact, my uncle was a vagabond, indigent. I mean, always stuck to his knitting, been married to the same woman for 20 years now, custodian, who now cleans out the schools that he once decided not to attend because he had found what he thought was his calling at the age of 15, despite my grandfather's insistence on the saving propensity of the liberal arts. He was the one of my uncles and aunts who didn't particularly take that to heart. He took a different sort of life to heart. But it was odd that the liberal arts then, the first book I wrote, Serenity, A Boxing Memoir, is largely a homage to him. He was frozen by those same liberal arts in a book.
Now, you've written about boxing over the years. How do you think having prize fighters in your family affected your views on what is probably the most controversial sport?
If indeed we can call boxing sport.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not so sure that we can. I think it's a bit of a stretch. But at the same time, it's just been fascinating ground for me as a writer over the years. Muhammad Ali, who I write about in What Black People Should Do Now, I write about him as sort of a harbinger more than anything else. I mean, here's this man in the early 60s, a very handsome man, standing up, just an exemplar of manhood, saying, I am the greatest, I am pretty, I am beautiful, I am a bad man. I mean, the effect that that had on me as a 10-year-old, 12-year-old is probably incalculable. Again, not that I wanted to be a boxer, but when I was a copy boy at the Oakland Tribune at the age of 23, making the late milk runs for the late papers at 3 a.m., I would go over to IBM Selectric typewriters and put in a fresh piece of paper and just type, Ralph Wiley's the greatest sports writer in the world, bar none. Ralph Wiley's the greatest sports writer in the world, bar none. Ralph Wiley's the greatest sports writer in the world, bar none. And that's the way that I was influenced by him or by the boxers. Just as I think, I hope, that Michael Jordan was a harbinger of today. In this way, an excellence, a harbinger of an excellence, of an expansion of the human envelope on capability. Because when I grew up, only the last man in the line could dunk, and he had to be very unreasonably tall. He had to be 6'10", 6'11". This was white or black. But there was a man named Julius Erving who preceded Michael. Michael was a young man, much as I was a young man with Ali. And Julius Erving, he says, Michael Jordan as a young man saying, this is possible. Now I will add what I can do to what is possible, and perhaps the envelope will expand. Now, he's not saying this consciously, much as I never wrote those words consciously referring to Ali. But I think this is how human endeavor is inevitably moved forward.
You went to segregated schools growing up in Memphis, and then you chose to go to a small black college, a college that isn't very well known.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you were offered a scholarship to one of the Ivy League schools and turned it down?
Yes. I write about this whole education issue in an essay in the book entitled Why Black People Sing the Blues. And it has to do with these very relevant issues of hate speech as opposed to free speech on college campuses now. And that's really the jumping off point of the essay. And yes, I guess in point of fact, you can say I went to segregated schools, but also the white children in Memphis went to segregated schools.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we all went to segregated schools, but somehow I'm the one that's supposed to carry the pathology. This is very common. You know, everybody was segregated, not just me.
Well, in your first collection of essays, Why Black People Tend to Shout, you have an article about integration in there. And in a lot of ways, you think integration has been a bum rap for African Americans.
Well, Terry, I think the integration was handled badly. The perfect analogy, I hate to keep going back to sports, but the perfect analogy is when the major leagues were integrated in 1947 with Jackie Robinson. And it was put forth as this great social experiment, and actually a lot of people didn't like it. But it was not institutional integration. It was integration of a sort of a talented 3% or something. And that led to the demise of the institutions of the Negro League-owned baseball team. So instead of including the Kansas City Monarchs and the Homestead Grays in the major leagues, you know, the top 10 or 18 or 20 ball players were taken, and naturally these other teams died. They folded. And a very similar thing happened in the way integration was implemented in the country. I mean, I've always preferred desegregation. I mean, you can't force people together. What you can do is force a sense of equality and a sense of equal access.
Further the analogy for me. You made the analogy of how the black baseball teams died out after the best players, and only the best players, made it to the major leagues. Further the analogy in terms of what you think has happened to certain neighborhoods.
Well, like S.A. Owen Junior College, where I grew up, from ages 2 to 11, that's sort of a young mascot. It's not there anymore. There's a junior high there with no windows that can be seen from the street. There were theaters all over inner cities. There was a movie theater across the fence from my backyard in Memphis called the W.C. Handy. And I would go up there every weekend and watch very forgettable films, but I do remember The Magnificent Seven. But
oh, great film.
but most of those theaters have been closed down now. And if you look at any major city, you can see that theater now. And then 9 times out of 10, it's closed. Some of the best high schools, potentially in the country, were closed down, were forgotten, were left in disrepair, and only the worst teachers or the worst principals and all the talented students were taken out. So then what you have left is just not a great environment, and people say, oh, look at this. Well, there's a reason. There's reasons that these things happen. And I just think I'm really trying to get people. I mean, I have a lot of humorous lines in the book, but even the humorous lines are intended to make you think.
Okay. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, Terry, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Ralph Wiley is the author of the new book, What Black People Should Do Now, Dispatches from Near the Vanguard. This is Fresh Air. It's the day of the long-awaited NAFTA vote. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what do you have coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. The gentlewomen and gentlemen who will decide these matters have been making speeches all day on the floor of the House. We'll hear some of that debate. And a report on the last-minute deal-making in Washington. John Itzty reviews the way NAFTA would affect the various businesses around the country. F. Lipson has a story from Little Rock, Arkansas, about the high murder rate and gang activity in that town. Also, Patricia Wells has a new book. She's a well-known food writer, a book about Italy's trattorias, including some recipes for pasta and a bread you can make in 15 minutes.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Throughout his long career, novelist E.L. Doctorow has used his fiction to express his sometimes controversial views on American history and politics. His first book of essays, entitled Jack London, Hemingway, and the Constitution, has just been published. It's a collection of 14 pieces he's written over the last 3 decades on topics ranging from Thoreau's Walden to the character of recent U.S. presidents. Critic Maureen Corrigan says the impassioned moralism of Doctorow's voice doesn't lose anything in the translation from fiction to nonfiction.
You probably heard the news that the Walt Disney Company is going to build a new theme park called Disney's America outside of Washington, D.C. Unlike Disney's other parks, this one will concentrate solely on American history. Disney officials say they especially want to present the conflicts in our nation's history, in a way that won't offend anybody. So there'll be exhibits on Native Americans, slavery, and Vietnam. There will also be rides. In one exhibit devoted to the Industrial Revolution, tourists can pretend to be workers escaping from a fiery vat of molten steel. Oh, for the good old days, before health and safety regulations cut down on all those fun industrial accidents. I foresee thousands of angry articles denouncing this new Disney park. But as far as I'm concerned, the most devastating criticism of Disney's Mickey Mousing around with history was published 22 years ago in E.L. Doctorow's masterpiece, The Book of Daniel. In that novel, Doctorow's spoilsport hero, Daniel Isaacson, visits Disneyland and wittily dismantles the historical pretensions of Tomorrowland and the Pirates of the Caribbean. Take it from me. You can still have fun at Disneyland after reading the Book of Daniel, but you'll never go there again without also feeling like a sucker. E.L. Doctorow has always considered it part of his sacred responsibility not only to entertain and educate, but also to offend his readers, to shame us, to make us think. In his novels, Doctorow has toured the trouble spots of American history. He's written about McCarthyism, the Depression, and the 1960s in a way that's illuminated their mythic significance. That same double vision effect is evident in his first collection of essays, entitled Jack London, Hemingway, and the Constitution. There are sharp appreciations here of Hemingway, Dreiser, Orwell, and Tolstoy. In a perceptive essay on Jack London and his Nietzschean superdog, Buck, Doctorow discusses London's character flaws, making him sound a bit like H. Ross Perot. Doctorow claims London had the self-taught, self-made man's weakness for the idea that explains everything. But it's clear that Doctorow has an old-fashioned high regard for politically engaged writers like London, who he says were great gobblers up of the world. By this same standard, Doctorow denounces Ronald Reagan as nothing but a professional fantasist, an actor who only imitated real life, sort of a human Disneyland. Doctorow's essay on the Constitution is a lyrical testament to those words that were so powerful they actually composed a nation. But he's at his best in the angry pieces reprinted here. I would have loved to have been in the audience at Brandeis University in 1989 when Doctorow gave a now-famous commencement speech praising the recently deceased Brandeis alumni, Abby Hoffman. I wonder how the college's fundraising efforts fared after that speech. Like Hoffman, Doctorow has tried hard throughout his career to be a nuisance. Doctorow says, writers should be, at best, inconvenient, like some old relative in mismatching pants and jacket who knocks on our door during a dinner party to remind us from what we come. I hope E.L. Doctorow never gets tired of knocking.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. E.L. Doctorow's new collection is called Jack London, Hemingway, and the Constitution. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Nancy Greenlease and Dorothy Farabee. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. Abby Fanta and Devin Reef are our interns. I'm Terry Gross.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and by the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3395. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Ed Ryder served 20 years in prison for a murder he says he didn't commit. His life sentence was just commuted by the acting governor of Pennsylvania. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Ryder and James McCluskey, the minister who believed in Ryder's innocence and worked to free him. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.